It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone, on this episode of 30 with Murdy, a conversation with Curt Flood Jr. 50 years ago, his father, Curt Flood, kickstarted free agency in baseball. In December 1969, Flood was traded from St. Louis to Philadelphia, and after 12 years as a Cardinal, Flood objected to the idea that he had no control over where he chose to work within the sport. The basic agreement's reserve clause held a player to his original team for as long as that team wanted the player. Flood's refusal to report to the Phillies and accept the terms of being traded, and the letter that he sent to Commissioner Bowie Kuhn essentially ended his career. The letter's most famous line, "After 12 years in the major leagues, I do not feel that I am a piece of property to be bought and sold irrespective of my wishes." Flood's case went all the way to the Supreme Court in a losing cause. He was denied free agency, and after sitting out the 1970 season, the Phillies traded his rights to the Washington Senators. At 33 years old, after a losing fight, Flood was a broken man physically and emotionally. He played just 13 games for Washington in 1971 before abruptly quitting and fleeing to Europe, his career officially over. But within 5 years, Marvin Miller and the Players Union won the subsequent battles, and the players won their rights to free agency, and the sport would never be the same. Flood challenged the system at the beginning of the 1970s. By the end of that decade, Reggie Jackson signed with the Yankees, Pete Rose with the Phillies, Nolan Ryan with the Astros. The game's biggest stars were on the move for big dollars and finally had some measure of control over their careers. Today, free agency can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and when Gerrit Cole signed with the Yankees last December for 9 years and $324 million, he publicly thanked Miller and Flood for their efforts 50 years ago. Miller was finally elected to the Hall of Fame by the Special Veterans Committee in December. Miller, the founding head of the Players Union, will be inducted into Cooperstown this summer, along with Derek Jeter, Larry Walker, and Ted Simmons. Meanwhile, Curt Flood will be a candidate for the next committee ballot, the Golden Days ballot, next December, and Flood's family is leading a campaign to get him elected to the Hall of Fame for his trailblazing efforts. Flood finished a 15-year career in 1971, a fabulous center fielder on great Cardinals teams in the 60s. Flood won 7 Gold Gloves, made 3 All-Star teams, and was part of 2 World Series champions, 1964 and 1967. The 68 Cardinals lost a 7-game series to the Tigers. With respect to modern metrics, Flood compiled a 42 WAR, good for 302nd all-time, slightly below the career totals of notables like Daryl Strawberry, Dale Murphy, and Jorge Posada. And Flood's career 100 OPS plus means as an offensive player, he was league average. In his personal life, Flood endured a divorce and struggle with alcohol. And after fleeing from his last playing job in Washington, Flood lived in Europe for several years. In 15 years on the Hall of Fame ballot, Curt Flood peaked at 15% in 1996. He died in 1997. His name has appeared on 3 Veterans Committee ballots since he passed away in 2003, 2005, and 2007. Voting ranged from 12 to 17%, again, well shy of the 75% tally needed for election to the Hall. When the next Golden Days Committee meets next December, they will consider players whose greatest contributions came between 1950 and 1969. Flood's children have begun to campaign for his inclusion on this ballot and for his election on the ballot. Curt Flood Jr. is the oldest of Flood's 3 biological children. He had 2 other adopted children. In January, I spoke to Curt Jr. from his home in Los Angeles. Here is my conversation with Curt Flood Jr. Curt, first thing I want to ask you is, what do people say to you when they hear your name?
It depends upon where in the country I am. in the Midwest, it really resonates with people, and up until 1940, St. Louis was the westernmost city for Major League Baseball, and so they drew fans from 4 different states, 5 different states around Missouri, and I traveled in that part of the country, and it really resonates, and it stops people in their tracks, and they want to find out more about. Whether I'm related and how I'm related that sort of thing.
It was a little bit different when you were a teenager, wasn't it?
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles. So, my dad moved us from St. Louis to Northern California in the early 60s, and we subsequently moved to L.A. Around 68, 59, and lived in a neighborhood where, you know, there were, you know, there was a number of Dodger players, Tommy Davis, Willie Davis, Jim Gilliam, those folks were there, Ray Charles, Tina Turner. Wow. It was sort of the go-to place for the black affluent in Los Angeles, neighborhood called Windsor Hills, View Park, Baldwin Hills, Ladera Heights. And, you know, again, you know, had I grown up in St. Louis, you know, it, yeah, it may have been different, but, you know, my dad was, you know, although he's well known, he was a little low on the celebrity totem pole.
Yeah.
You know, in the neighborhood I grew up in.
I want to ask you more about that in a little bit, but obviously you and your family are behind this movement to get your dad, Curt Flood, inducted into the Hall of Fame. And there's another special committee ballot that comes up next December that he has a chance to be a part of. Your dad was recognized and honored at the 2015 Hall of Fame awards ceremony on the Hall of Fame weekend there, as part of that special ceremony. Were you or your family there and involved in any of that?
No. I think my stepmother, my former stepmother, Judy Pace, may have been involved in it.
Okay.
But, you know, her involvement and my involvement and my sibling's involvement are two separate camps, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no, his kids, you know, were not involved in that. The workup to it, you know, really wasn't even publicized.
So how and why did your family begin this campaign?
Well, this is the 50th anniversary of his, you know, historic letter to Bowie Kuhn, you know, outlining, you know, what he felt was, you know, fair and reasonable in terms of being able, after, you know, 12 years of playing at the major league level, that he should be able to have more say so, you know, with the trajectory of his career. And, you know, as you know, at that time, that was an impossibility with the reserve clause.
Yeah.
You know, that had been in place for decades and decades. And he just sort of felt that he was the one to bring it, you know, to the table and try to diplomatically come to an agreement, you know, he, you know, outlined what he was interested in doing and notifying the rest of the clubs that of his availability. And of course, you know, he was denied in a letter from Bowie Kuhn a few days later, and opted instead to file a lawsuit on January 16th of 1969. And that is the 50th anniversary of the filing of the lawsuit. And as you mentioned, the Golden Age Committee will meet in early December at the winter meetings in Dallas. And vote.
That's how Ted Simmons, former Cardinal, got elected this past year, and we'll see what the committee turns up this time. This is something that's important to you now, more because of the 50th anniversary and how much recognition that your father is getting for the celebration of that right now.
Well, you know, with social media, his legacy, I think, has really benefited and been boosted, as well as, you know, his story and our story. You know, it's been meaningful for decades, you know, to me and my siblings. But you know, this year, again, the Golden Age Era Committee will meet in December, and they only meet once every 5 years now.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is, I don't see a better opportunity than this year, and with it coinciding with the 50th anniversary, and with it coinciding with such a new level of awareness and with great insight and support from people like Garrett Cole,
yeah,
and you know, Martina Navratilova and Billie Jean King. I mean, you know, it's an extraordinary feeling and one that I haven't felt, you know, in any of the decades past, in terms of, you know, my dad's value and, you know, with Billie Jean tweeting, you know, it's just been incredible.
What did, you know, when you mentioned Garrett Cole, I was really taken aback at the press conference where he was introduced as a Yankee and he mentioned Marvin Miller and Curt Flood and thanked both of them. I'll get to Marvin in a second, but just I'm sure it was unexpected to you when you heard Garrett Cole, who just signed for $324 million to be a New York Yankee, and he steps up and one among the first words he speaks in a Yankee uniform, he's thanking Curt Flood. What did that mean to you?
You know, it was absolutely a special and you know, it's something that has never happened before. You know, and I was blindsided, but yeah, you know, again with social media and this new awareness that I mean, my dad is folklore in most of the locker rooms,
mm-hmm.
But to actually hear it. You know, from a guy who clearly has identified, you know, his great fortune and signing such an extraordinary contract and the ability to move around the league. No, it felt amazing. He clearly, you know, recognizes that he stands on the shoulders of people that sacrificed a great deal and had extraordinary imagination and vision. Long before Major League Baseball did, and the owners did, and even the players, you know, did. There were many players who sided with ownership in terms of the reserve clause, and so yeah. I mean, fast forward to Garrett Cole. I had actually been in conversations with Scott Bourque. Over the last couple of years, I'm connected with him on LinkedIn, and previously, about 3 months ago, to Garrett Cole's announcement, I had begun conversations with them as well about the possibility of supporting Curt Flood for Cooperstown, and so the notion that one of his players was right on top of it. It seemed to me immediately that Scott Boras had you know, probably had a little bit of a hand in it. But then later I learned that what's his name, John Buck, had actually schooled Garrett Cole and many other rookies, you know, coming up on, you know, the history of free agency and from signing lifetime contracts to being able to dictate the course and trajectory of your career, of their careers.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have them stand up and on the bus, you know, and give book reports about Curt Flood. So yeah, so there was a combination of elation and just satisfaction that a player of that caliber had thought enough to recognize, you know, those that had come before him, you know, and had fought the good fight.
I imagine then that the election of Marvin Miller to the Hall of Fame meant a lot to you as well.
Yeah, it was terrific. Marvin, of course, was a early advocate on behalf of my father and was a partner for the most part in bringing the lawsuit to against Major League Baseball, through, you know, as it wended its way through the lower courts and onto the Supreme Court, and served as an advisor and friend and confidant. He, along with my dad, you know, short of Jackie Robinson, I believe, are one of the most instrumental and important figures in at least the way that sports business is done over the past 50 years. And I know the history of Marvin not wanting to be considered any longer, you know, for the Hall of Fame. You know, it was just a great feeling that that he had finally been recognized. You know, this may be a little snide, but, you know, guys like Jerry Reinsdorf had to sit through, the election announcement. It was a great thing.
You know, for people who aren't aware, and I, you know, just doing research, I was not fully aware. The relationship between you and your father and your siblings and your father, it wasn't quite storybook because, you know, your mom and dad divorced when you were quite young. What kind of a relationship did you have with your dad in those years when he was, you know, when he was playing and as he was leading up to this fight and then in the years after that?
You know, my parents married when they were, you know, 18 and 19 years old. My dad, respectively, my dad was 19. My mom was 18 or so. And my mom had actually had two children from a previous marriage. Mm-hmm. And so my dad had, you know, he had adopted my older brother and sister. I was the first, hence junior, in 1960. My sister Shelley came along in 61, and my little brother came along in 65. So when I came along, my dad had been in the league pretty much for about, you know, 4 or 5 years, and was a veteran. And my earliest memories, you know, go back to Sportsman's Park, being 4 or 5 years old, and the 3 years, you know, or 4 years after that were absolutely special. You know, my brother and I would go to spring training. My dad was, he was a quiet, loving, interpersonal, funny, clever human being. And it was a feeling of being cocooned and something really very special. Little did I know that of course I couldn't have known at that age, but to be a ball player back then, just as it is today, the lifestyle, if you're not prepared for it, you know, if you're not mature and focused, and the lifestyle can consume you.
Yeah.
And at least back then, you know, guys drank heavy. They socialized in the bars and clubs and heavily. My dad, did it for all it was worth, you know, but it didn't necessarily bode well with marriage life, you know. Quite sure that there was infidelity that my mom had refused to absolutely to accept and deal with, and that, you know, essentially took a toll over the period of between 64 and 68 or so. Mm-hmm. So, and it probably happened a lot earlier than that, but you know, to a kid, you don't get it. Sure. You know, the time that it became apparent that something was wrong was when they had decided to split up around 66 or 67. Mind you, I'm 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah.
You know, his playing days, you know, my awareness of understanding of who and what he was and going to the ballparks and hanging out in locker rooms, you know, and going to spring training, you know, all of that was a real snapshot to me as a kid, looking back. You know, although it was a very cool one at the time, it was really a very short period. Mm-hmm. You know, in my family's life. You know, he went from being Gussie Bush's, you know, fair-haired kid to, you know, a very acrimonious relationship after the '68 World Series, and you know, largely in part due to, I believe, Game 7 and Jim Northrup's line drive, you know, to center that he misjudged.
Yeah.
And, you know, he accepted full responsibility. But, you know, the fans and the organization really never let him forget it. Wow. And, I mean, I hear it today. You know, after that, it was pretty much downhill for him as a St. Louis Cardinal was concerned. Really, that period was when my family really began to see less and less of him and where the break really happened.
And funny, because he's actually part of two World Series champions, that you say people bring up the misplay in 68 that ends up winning Game 7 for the Tigers. He still has two World Series rings. You've got one of those, and the way I was reading it, it was given to you when you were, a teenager still, maybe not even, and it was kind of unceremonious and almost out of guilt for not having been there and for the things that were going on in your life when you were young. What do you recall about that, about getting the World Series ring from your father?
Well, you know, my dad came back to the States pretty much a broken man, you know, completely rudderless. His health had diminished. You know, he was really starting from ground zero with respect to, again, his health and not only his physical health, but his mental health. And this thing broke my dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it absolutely eviscerated him in a way that it's hard to describe. You know, Major League Baseball was the only business my dad knew. You know, being a ball player was the only profession that he had. You know, those that supported him and over the years, the alienation that happened and those that had previously supported him had essentially made him an outcast. It's almost like losing your family.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really took a toll on him. And when he came back to the States in around 1977 or so, it was a slow process in regaining his physical and mental health. But it was a couple of years after he had gotten back and he had taken my younger brother Scott and I bowling. Hmm. And here in LA, and we were bowling and sitting there having a beer, and he simply took it off his hand and handed it to me, and he said, you know, I'm sorry. So yeah, I mean, there was a measure of guilt, but also he felt that he'd always felt that gifts would mend our relationship, but this was different, you know. There was no pompous circumstance or you know, really unceremonious.
Yeah.
But you know, the ring actually didn't even fit. You know, I had to wrap tape on the inside for it to fit. You know, that was I guess 1977 or so, 17 or so, and I've had it ever since.
Your father ended up passing away in 1997. And he had some time on the Hall of Fame ballot and never really gained serious traction there. And obviously that's why, one of the reasons why you and your family are still campaigning here. But what do you recall about, you know, the last few years you were able to spend with your father, you know, not only just you and your family's relationship, but maybe his relationship with the game and how he felt about it?
He was a tough read because, you know, he wasn't, very, forthcoming his feelings. I mean, he tended to shoulder things on his own, and I think as he had always done as the youngest family member and being the runt of the family, and coming up through, you know, the segregated South, when he was, in the minor leagues, and he did all of that on his own, you know, and even up and through the time he was picked up by the Cardinals, and through like 63, 60, early 64, you know, having Solly Hemus, who was a registered racist, as his manager, he really had to do things on his own, you know, and he really matured, you know, on his own spirit and merits, and fast forward to healing himself and getting back, to a level of health and emotional and physical and psychological health. He did a lot of that on his own. There was a period of 10 years, you know, essentially when his health had regained and he got to a place in his life where those things were behind him and he started, working with kids in the Bay Area and Oakland, and there was a park named after him, and, you know, he began playing in these old-timers games and Randy Humley Sports Fantasy Camp, and, you know, being invited back into the family of baseball. Not completely, but, enough that hole, you know, that had emptied when he essentially was an outcast, it began to fill back up, you know, and I was able to attend some of those games and be a part of his life and he a part of mine for a solid decade. And it was nice, you know, and he died at 59, you know, and I was 37. That's just too early, yeah. You know. We should be together right now, you know, and reminiscing and enjoying life. But life had other plans. You know, it usually does. He was able to see a measure of my success. I got my start in communications at 20th Century Fox. And here in L.A., this is before Fox Sports, before Fox Cable, before the Internet, in fact. And my boss was a guy called Dennis Petrovsky, who coincidentally was Dale Petrovsky's brother, the former president of Cooperstown.
Sure.
You know, he taught me that he was Rupert Murdoch's right-hand guy to the media and had worked under Barry Diller prior to that. But he taught me the business of writing effectively and cultivating, nurturing, developing relationships with people like yourself. And it was a great gig. And my dad would come to the lot and have lunch with me in the commissary. And, you know, he was able to see that things had generally worked out okay for at least me, you know. And each of my siblings had a different relationship with my dad, and we each had to explore ways to mend that fence that had been torn down as a result of the case that essentially destroyed his life and our life.
You carry his name personally, but you and your family also run the Curt Flood Foundation. What does the Curt Flood Foundation stand for and do?
Well, the mission is that we partner with like-minded and like-spirited organizations on behalf of ethnic minority girls and young women. And in the areas of health and wellness and fitness, you know, social relationships, the mission was revitalized and refreshed last January with a new partnership with Baseball for All, which is the girls baseball tournament organization founded by Dr. Justine Siegel. And if you don't know Dr. Siegel's story, she was or is the first woman to coach at the major league level. You know, she's thrown batting practice to five or six clubs, and she started this organization because as a kid she had termed out. I mean, she played little league baseball and pony league, and when she got to high school there were a few options to continue playing. So fast forward to 10 years ago, she started this organization, Baseball for All, which puts on tournaments, eight tournaments around the country, for girls, solely for girls. It provides girls and young women an opportunity to continue playing this sport, actually from age 7 through 17, so there's no break. There are 100,000 girls playing baseball at the T-ball, Little League, Pony League level at any one time, you know, in the United States. When that 100,000 number hits high school, that drops down to 1,000 girls.
Wow.
You know, continuing to play baseball beyond that. She is absolutely, her organization is somebody that fits within our mission. You know, we're raising money to help her continue to do this incredible job of enabling girls to not have to give up on their passion and dream. We're looking at working with Steph Curry's organization, Live Eat Play, and just to again, to align ourselves with like-minded organizations that provide opportunities for young women and girls to, you know, maximize opportunities that generally, are not available to them.
You're obviously doing a lot to keep that name alive, and it sounds like a lot of good work. As this year goes on and your campaign rolls on to try to get your dad elected to the Hall of Fame in December, if that doesn't happen, are you satisfied with what your dad's legacy has become and over these last 50 years, gone from a guy who, as you said, was a broken man because he was run out of the game to somebody who is celebrated on the grandest scales here and whose legacy is known throughout baseball, even if it doesn't end with a plaque on the wall in Cooperstown? Are you satisfied with where your father's legacy is in the game?
Actually, I'm not satisfied, and I doubt that I will ever be satisfied, because the legacy doesn't end with him being enshrined or not being enshrined. His legacy will continue through the Kirk Flood Foundation and being of service to young people in the community, and with his name attached, absolutely. Because that's who he was, and that's what he was about, you know, and that's what he would want today. Mm-hmm. Whether he's inducted, you know, next December or not, we will continue doing what we're doing and continue raising visibility and awareness about who he is with young players and actually with all players, with the labor unions, with their agents, with the fans, with journalists, with young journalists, to keep it alive. Even if he is elected to Cooperstown, our main goal will be that, he's not forgotten.
To be clear, Kurt Flood is represented at the Hall of Fame in a number of ways. The Whole New Ballgame exhibit includes a copy of his historic letter to Commissioner Bowie Kuhn. Flood's autobiography, The Way It is also on display. And during the 2015 Hall of Fame induction weekend, Flood was honored during the Saturday Awards presentation. The next day, the Hall of Fame inducted Pedro Martinez, Randy Johnson, John Smoltz, and Craig Biggio, who combined to earn $538 million in their careers. Flood, in 15 major league seasons, earned an estimated total of $472,000. All these figures are as found on baseballreference.com. But Kurt Flood's plaque in the Hall of Fame is another matter altogether. With less than 20% support in each of his 18 previous ballots, it's hard to think he will be elevated to 75% this year. But it is absolutely worth talking about his legacy for the generation of players that might know his name, but not know exactly why they should know his name. Among the other names in consideration for this ballot in December will be Gil Hodges, a Brooklyn Dodger hero and the manager of the 1969 Mets. A big thank you to the Society for American Baseball Research. The folks at Sabre have some terrific player bios that are linked via Baseball Reference. My thanks to both of those sites and to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown
for providing some background and research material. You can read Kurt Flood's bio at saber.org, and you can check out the mission of the Families Foundation at kurtfloodfoundation.org. My thanks to Kurt Flood Jr. for his time on the subject. If you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive at radio.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe, review, and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.